Hello, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, depending on where you are, and welcome to another fabulous edition of Skid Row Chatter with myself, your host, Tom Pitts, and today's guest, the world-famous author, Johnny Shaw. Johnny, you may know Johnny, but I'm going to rattle off a few of his accomplishments for the listeners who may not. The one and only Johnny Shaw, he is the author of novels Dove Season, Big Maria, Plaster City, and Floodgate, more on the way. And his short stories have appeared in Thuglit, Plots with Guns, Shotgun Honey, Crime Factory, Blood and Tacos, and all the other usual places you might suspect. He was an Anthony Award winner for Big Maria. He's gotten nominations and the Two Spotted Owl Awards, which I'm not really sure what that is. And there's something out here about Brace Godfrey we're going to have to investigate towards the end of the show. Welcome aboard, Johnny Shaw. How are you feeling today? Oh, are you not there?
Yeah. Oh,
you back on, Johnny?
Yeah. Hey, I'm back here. I think it just said unmuted. Thanks for having me. Good to be here. Good. It'll be fun to talk.
I'm glad to know I have that mute button now that I noticed it, just in case.
Yeah, exactly. You might need it.
I need a big red button is what I need. So you're out there in the world, flouting. Is that the right word? Pushing Floodgate, your new novel. That came out what 3 months ago, 4 months ago?
Came out in February. So I'm kind of past and done with the push. I mean, I still tell people that I wrote it. It's not a secret. But all the promo stuff is done, and now I'm much more of a I'd rather be sitting and writing kind of guy. So I'm kind of back. Back at the desk working.
Well, not for
but
the next hour. The next hour you were promoting and you were not writing. You're entertaining my hungry and thirsty listeners. So Floodgate, Floodgate took me by surprise.
I got nothing.
All,
I can't hear you.
You can't hear me? Hang on. And here I was saying that, can you hear me now? Johnny. I might just have to advance until I can get it back.
Holy shit.
You can't hear me now? Yeah, let's try it again. Well, that's not good. Can you hear me now, Johnny? Let me try to mute my mic and then come back.
I'm going
to
hang up and let you call me back. I got nothing.
Oh, heavens to Murgatroyd. All right, we're going to call Johnny back here in a second, which is odd. We're going to go ahead and blame it on him. Hang on 1 second while I call in the tech support. Through the magic that is the internet, we'll have the show back up and running, and I'll pontificate myself on whether my own.
There I am. You there?
There. Can you hear me now?
Yeah. I just called you back. Yeah. I can hear you.
Well, that is bizarre. Well, that's a little bump. After I was just saying we had no technical difficulties. All right. So
yeah, I don't know if you could hear me. I couldn't hear you, but that's fine.
Yeah, well, let's move on here. I want to talk about Floodgate. And my first, aside from the extensive monologue I just gave saying your book was great, where the hell is Auction City? That's what I want to know.
Well, I'm never going to totally pin it down. And I'll tell you the origin of Auction City. Myself and another author, Bart Lessard, Lessard. He's a writer. You can find his books. Great writer. He and I were collaborating on a comic book that we wanted to create maybe a dozen years ago. I've known him a long time. And this is way before I was writing books. I was a screenwriter and a playwright. Still am, I guess, technically. And we were developing this, basically the same premise of Floodgate, very different. But he was the one that came up with the name Auction City. I know that for sure. And then we kind of developed some of the history together. And then it was just abandoned. And then I became a book writer. And I was like, oh, that would be an interesting thing to explore. And so I got permission from him to kind of go back to those old notes. And it really, I mean, it evolved over time, even though that was the genesis. This Auction City is, probably, I mean, 90, whatever. It's its own thing. So, Auction City was there. It was always exactly. It's a little more specific because there's some references in it. It was Auction City was supposed to be, we wanted it kind of right around the Mason-Dixon line on the East Coast. So it's not any city.
Where do you have it? My brain was a little more Midwestern. I noticed the snow right away. I'm like, it feels like a Chicago suburb. It's not really important where it is so much. That was just sort of an opening question to bring up Auction City, because it acts like a character in this book. More so, I mean, setting I know is important in your books, but more so than the other books, I felt that Auction City actually is a character. Would you say?
Well, yeah. I'm not going to give too much away of the book. I mean, who cares? But I could have said it in a. I guess I could have said it in a real city, but then I would have had to pretend like all this history of that city existed. And so the easier way to make, there's an event in the book called the Flood, which is like this giant gang riot fight, you know, that kind of burns the whole city down. And that had to happen for the rest of the story to kind of work. So why not? It was easier to just make up a city, give it history, and then slowly build it and give it, you know, and that, it was a challenge because you don't want to do so much world building that you don't have a story. Because that shit's fun, you know. Like
on the header of each chapter, there's like it's either an old song lyric or a politician's quote or you know or whatever it is, a piece of poem, whatever about Auction City, and that really lends to the history that you built around this town. I mean, those are all fictional, right? Or did you pull any of those from the real world?
Oh, no, those are all, I made, like, the blues song I wrote, and whatever it was, I just made it up. And, yeah, it's what it did was it gave a sense, none of those are stories, but it gave a sense that other things were happening in the city and through the history of the city. So it suggests that the city has a life. Like, it's the same with, like, mentioning neighborhoods that you never go to. Like, it's kind of filling it in very simply without overwhelming the reader and letting the action speak for itself. Like, in science fiction or fantasy, it's much more common to have world building. And I wanted to kind of pull that idea, but within a crime novel, but without it being too kind of overblown.
Well, yeah, it gives sort of the background and backstory a texture that it wouldn't otherwise have, and it's done nice and subtly, you know. It just the whole tone, you know. I'd read a couple of your books before.
I'm not subtly wouldn't be the word I would use. That's not a word that's used to describe me usually.
Well, I'd read a couple of your other books, and the first thing I thought when I cracked this one is this isn't El Centro. This isn't, you know, this isn't the southern part of California. And and then I realized that it opens in another time completely. And I had wondered if it was a period piece. And then it jumped up to not modern, you know, or present time, but in the 80s. Why, you know, it's a dual period piece. And so why choose the 80s instead of it jumping up to the present?
Partly because it's about kind of criminal organizations, and I think the strength of a city's criminal organization, like the idea of, like, you know, in the past, Chicago Mafia or something, I think those lines have become blurred a lot more. Like, as things became more global, someone controlling a city kind of meant less, because you could just go to another, like, it. So it feels like about the time where the power of these groups is going to start to get smaller. It wasn't about like cell phones or anything like that. It wasn't, I mean, although you get an advantage by not having that technology, it had more to do with how the technology affected criminal organizations. And I felt like they still needed to be powerful enough because it's about a city. Some people would say, like, oh, why doesn't, because I don't really mention the federal government that much, like other agencies and other things. So I wanted it still to have that quality, to be like kind of isolated. And I felt like if I pushed it too far into the present, it wouldn't make sense to make it that isolated. That was kind of the justification.
It definitely sort of helps support the idea of it being its own world, you know. I won't stay on it too long, but I do want to talk about Andy Dester, the main character, because he's an ex-cop, but to me, Joe Reeder, he doesn't have that. You know, it's not like you're hanging out with Bosch. You know what I mean? He doesn't have that cop quality, other than his weird sort of compulsion to solve his need to know. Other than that, I mean, he's not your typical cop. He feels very much like an everyman.
He's just not your typical book cop. Like, when you look at archetypes in books, yeah, I think that you'll see, like, oh, that's what a cop is. But shit, I mean, I've met cops that are goofballs. Like, I mean, I don't feel like there's one personality that solely fits into being any profession, including a cop. And I think there was times when the backstory was actually a little stronger, where it pushed him, where his parents' criminal past pushed him toward there was some sort of justification. Yeah. And then I usually write a ton of backstory and then just cut it all out, because who cares? And so, but it's all there somewhere in my brain. So there was some really good, I'm sure brilliant justification for why he was a cop. But I didn't feel like him being a cop had very little to do with his personality. I felt like he could be a cop and be any personality.
Do you feel
so
like
I didn't feel the need for the archetype.
Do you feel like breaking stereotypes is part of your purpose in fiction? I mean, I know I feel like it is. I don't know if I succeed in doing it, but I feel that calling. Do you think that's an important part of what you do? Is going against the grain of what people expect?
Definitely, I have a, like, if I catch, like, cliches or even, you know, kind of, what's the word that everyone uses that always gets tropes? That's a good one.
Yeah, tropes.
Like, you get these things that are common. I tend to do the opposite. It's one of the reasons I use humor. It's one of the reasons, partly it's just, I think when you're writing, There's two parts of you that are interplaying. There's the things you want to express, the things you want to say. That's you as the writer. There's also a part of it as you as the reader and what you want to read and what you want to absorb. And so balancing those two out, I know what I hate when I read. And I know the things that bug me. And if I do them and someone catches me on it, that really resonates. Like, I make my, when I teach as well, and I teach screenwriting, I make my students watch bad movies to remind them, if they do it, I'll tell them they did that. And it resonates much more than as much as watching good movies. That, like, you want to be able to, because there are a lot of, there's a lot of popcorn books that are meant to be a certain thing. Meaning when you pick it up, you don't want to think. You just want to read the book that's very similar to the last book that guy wrote. And that's fine. I understand that. I just don't want to write it. I understand it from a reader's point of view, but I don't want to write it. And so those fall into very familiar territory. Yeah, repeat that. Sorry.
I was saying, we're not specifically looking at you, Lee Child, but, you know, if the shoe fits.
I'm not faulting me to what he does. You can't just – what he does is not easy. I couldn't do it. I can't do what he does. Because I wouldn't know when it was good and when it was parody. Like, I don't know the difference. Like, I can't see that line. Like, I would write it and think, like, oh, I nailed it. And you'd be like, it's over the top. And then I would write it over the top, and they'd be like, that's perfect. I honestly wouldn't have any clue. Because I think Lee Child would say, it's silly. It's a little silly. You know, that's fine. I hope that's not an insult, because I don't mean it as one. It's big, silly fun.
I think, not to belabor that specific example that I brought up, just, you know, hopefully it won't be sued later. I've only read
one of his books. So I've only read one of his books, so I can't really
I went through
speak
several
to that. But yeah,
on my long commute, I do some audiobooks when I drive back and forth from Sacramento to San Francisco. And I listened to several in a row. And there's definitely a pattern and a style and a formula he uses. But it seems to me that he's got a pretty firm grip on what he does. I don't think he's kidding himself.
Oh,
he's not like going to write the great American novel the next time out.
Well, he's a smart dude, and he's also writing it from an interesting, because he's British, so he's writing the American novel from a very kind of different outsider point of view that, like, or I mean, he's not really that much of an outsider, but, you know, no, I find it really, no, I think he's very conscious of what he's doing, and like I said, I think he does it well, so I just personally... I don't like a character that doesn't get the shit beaten out of him. Like, I just don't. I don't like a character that's. I like kind of a little bit dumb and not very good at fighting characters. Like, I like characters that have a harder time getting out of trouble than somebody that's just a super badass. What do you do with that? I don't know.
Well, that is a fine segue for me to bring up the first book I read of yours, Big Maria.
I'm a pro, Tom. I'm a proper pro. I can do those segues.
That book moved me in a way that it was one of those books I read that, you know, sometimes you read a book and it inspires you to write, and sometimes you read a book that that inspires you to give up. You know, it's like, oh, I can never do that. And Big Maria was one of those ones that it's well crafted, and it is. And I don't know how much of that was just by accident, or by chance, or by design. But it's a real, it is like the anti-hero story where you got those three poor bastards who are broken upon broken, and just in case they're not broken enough, you literally in one case break them a little more. And the trials and tribulations of those guys. It seems to be such a. I'm surprised. Has that been optioned for a movie?
No. I get calls, but I'm surprised it hasn't too. I think it would be because it's kind of built for it. You know, it's got the good shape. I think it would be. There were people that are interested, but not right now. Anyone out there? So
yeah,
it's a good. Well, it'd make a good movie. I mean, I know a lot of people say. That, you know, their book would make a good movie. It, really, of the other ones you could just chuck away for that purpose. But, like, that would make a good movie. It would.
I don't know how difficult it would be to translate the humor, because it's definitely the backbone of what's happening to those poor bastards. But, you know, how did that book change? You know, you had written, you know, here's the, I'm going to stop and say this one thing. It's kind of often when I do these interviews, I research the author and, you know, maybe I read a book. And so I've got a grip. I've read several books. I don't really know anything about you. You know, even though I've met you a few times and I've seen you read live and stuff, I don't really, you know, for instance, until I started reading your books, I thought you were from Oregon. And that is so completely not the case. Well, I'm learning more, but I'm learning it through your fiction, which I guess is the way it should be done.
Design. Like, who cares about me? It's about the books. Go ahead.
Well, it is the way it should be. You're absolutely right. And it's not the way it always, and some writers certainly, personalities are bigger than their books. I'm looking at you, Ernest Hemingway. But, now what came out first? Did you write Dove Season first or Big Maria?
Oh, I wrote Dove Season first. I hadn't written I was a screenwriter, and I hadn't written like a short story since junior high, but I decided I had this story. It was very different when it started, that I wanted to try to write a novel, you know, cause why not? Every one of my books has like some sort of secret ambition or obvious ambition. Like Floodgate is obviously ambitious, but like, this was just, I didn't even tell my wife I was writing a novel until I was over 100 pages into it, because I wasn't convinced I would actually finish it. I don't like to talk about my work while I write it, well, because then I just won't do it. So I just went off in secret, because I would write every day, and she's, you know, she never asked what I'm doing. So I worked on it, and I got about halfway through it, and I was like, okay, this thing has legs. I can see where it's going. And then, so I just wrote it. And I wrote it in first person because coming from screenwriting, I had things that I was very confident about. Like I could write dialogue, I could structure the story, I could do there's things that carried over, but you don't have to write prose. Like the descriptions are very simple in screenwriting. So to draw someone into the story, I was not convinced I could do that. So I set it in all the locations or places I could take you to. Every single location is a real – different name, but a real place in my mind. So that way I could just kind of close my eyes, describe the place that exists, and then by telling it in the first person, I can use essentially my own voice, even though it's slightly different, to kind of tell it. And all my books should read like a drunk guy in a bar telling you a really good story. Like that's – there's going to be digressions, and it's going to go in different places, and it's going to be funny, and some shit's not even going to make sense, and I don't care. Like making – the book making sense is a very low priority for me. So with Dove Season, so I just – I don't know what – I didn't know what I was doing, which was a benefit, and I wrote it, and then all the publishing stuff, which is uninteresting. It, you know, worked out, and it kind of went out. It's I feel it's a, like now I look back, and I'm like, ah, I'd love to cut like 5,000, 10,000 words out of it, but that's, you know, that's the way it should be. And so when I – right. So when I went to – and then they were like, oh, you know, and now I have like – I guess a career. So whatever. So I was the, you know, you need a second book. Like, oh shit. Like, you know, so I was like, oh, it would be interesting to try to write in third person. Cause I don't know how to do that. And so, that was my ambition. And I really thought it was going to fail with Big Maria. And, but I wanted to tell the three guys, and it was the only way to do it.
The shift from first person to third person was something I wanted to ask you about. If it was like a something you had decided to do, or something that happened organically, but you know,
a little bit of both. I wanted to try it, but I also the story dictated it. It wouldn't have worked as well in first person.
I do find that you know when people talk about movies that are easily transferable to film or easily adaptable, there's something about writing in third person, I think that to a reader, because you are shifting scenes in your head along, along with the narrator. Well, I guess not so much narrator, but along with that omnipresent narrator, you're shifting scenes as right. You would in a movie. You know, you're not seeing movies aren't first person. So I think that lends a lot to the reader's ability to sort of like have that cinematic experience while they read. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think so. I think I never really thought about that, but you're probably right. I mean, it moves like a movie because it cuts more. Like if you feel like you're cutting from scene to scene a little quicker.
Yeah.
Definitely in the case of not all books cut really quickly though, even though they're in third. But yeah, you could be right. Like I don't have a neutral voice. Like it's its own thing. You could turn to a page and you know, you should be able to know it's my book. Like if you know my work at all.
Well, that's important. And that's natural. And that's important. And that's a good thing. But I mean, as a preference, I prefer third person, but it's not like it diminished. Actually, I remember asking you at About Your Con if, there were the obnoxious elevator questions. So which book should I read first? And you mentioning that Dove Season was much more personal. And you had mentioned your father and you're growing up, and I was ready for the tears to start rolling. I kept a box of Kleenex by the bed just in case, where it just sits anyway. And sure enough, there was a lot of laughter going on.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, it's like, I mean, that's the thing I know we're writing crime novels, right? It's whatever, like, but I don't get, and I read a ton of those kind of, you know, super bleak kind of Southern miserableism, kind of like where the world
Southern
is just, it starts out, you know what I mean? I described it to, I think yesterday to somebody, and I was describing, it was like, it's kind of like Irish. Like it's at the beginning, they have only have one potato, and by the end they're starving. It's like, they started out horribly and then it gets worse. And I get it. There's bleak things, poverty, like, and all these. But if you don't have humor as counterpoint to that, then you just have a bleak world. You just, there's no hope in it, because they're just gonna, even if they get out of the situation, they're just getting out to be in a bleak world. And I remember laughing growing up, and we didn't have much. And so it's one of the key defense mechanisms, or one of the survival techniques. When you're desperate, or when you're down, like, and so if you want to reflect life in a way in your books, and your book isn't funny at all, to me, like, that reads like parody. Like, it reads like you're, like, I mean, I could name authors, which I'm not going to do. And, so, and some of those books I like, even the really dark, dark ones, because there's a certain poetry to the misery in a way. But, like, I got to be in the mood for that because I don't believe it as the real world. I believe it as a construct. And
well,
so it kind of takes me out
capture,
of it.
If you're trying to capture what is what is real and have that verisimilitude, I think that, you know, from my own personal experience, being in peril and in tough spots and being involved in some criminal behavior, that sort of joking along the way, kind of whistling in the dark, and that's what people do. And I learned that. I attribute my ability to sort of joke when things are darkest is, you know, watching shows like MASH and stuff when you're little and everything becomes a one-liner, everything's a joke, and that doesn't stop when you're, you know, committing a crime or fleeing from criminals or whichever side of the fence you're on. There's still that underlying humor that I think is important. It's part of the human condition, I guess, right?
Absolutely. If you ask a cop what the most realistic cop show is, they'll say Barney Miller. There is, I'm not kidding. Or a lot of them, it's sort of gallows humor, or like, I mean, you ever heard doctors or nurses talk when they're not around? Holy crap. Like, it's brutal. Like it's how you survive those kind of situations. War is a perfect example. Like, MASH is a perfect example. Yeah, and to me, so that captures something that's far more real. And it's not about it being like the world being real. It's about the characters being three-dimensional. You know, there's something about that if you don't have that one element that, to me, I mean, in my life, I'm not going to get philosophical, but like the lowest points in my life are the moments that I've lost my sense of humor. Where the thing that happened was so bad or so dark and my sense of humor just went away. And I know the healing has started when I'm able to joke about it again.
Yeah.
And so if you have a character at the beginning who has a sense of humor, but then they lose it, that's a tragedy in itself. But if they don't have it from the beginning, who gives a shit?
Yeah.
So, I think it's essential. And I'm surprised there isn't more. Like, if you watch The Godfather, that's a funny movie. You'll laugh out loud at The Godfather. It's not a comedy, but it uses humor in a really, really interesting way.
Hey, leave the gun, take the cannolis. That's the best, one of the best one-liners in movie history. I got to just mention that this is a copyrighted podcast owned solely by the Authors on the Air Global Network. Got to mention that each time. And we're about at the halfway point. Someone just called, and I left them ringing too long, and they hung up. So we're going to open up the calls in a few minutes here. If you do want to call in, it's 347-633-6909. And you can speak to Johnny directly, or you can just heckle him and hang up. It's your call.
That's probably more likely.
I do want to ask you more about – you know, the humor thing, I've seen you read a couple times, and it's a side-splitting experience. And I was warned, you know, don't follow Johnny. That's the thing.
The story you read in Raleigh just absolutely destroyed me. You crushed it. That's not even me. That's me saying that right now. I was like, I'm glad I'm not following that dude.
That's my go-to.
That's what I said to myself.
That's my go-to. You know why? You know why it's funny? Because it's true. Those, I've got a handful of junkie stories that happened. They're all, you know, first person because they're real things, and that's where the humor comes in my own personal experience. That my crime stuff doesn't resonate as well when I read it live because it's not funny. And I think it's important to sort of have specifically the same cadence as a joke, but there needs to be a setup and a punchline for a story for it to really succeed live. How important is humor? Obviously it is important, but what is your take on humor in reading live specifically?
Oh, I wouldn't read not funny. Me personally, but that's because I have material. If I have a choice between reading funny and not reading funny. So some people don't necessarily have that choice. So for me, I'm always going to read funny. One, I'm a sucker for the instant gratification of somebody laughing. I don't know if they liked it, if I'm trying to make them think or feel other feeling. Are there other feelings? Whatever, those other feelings. And so that I will always go for the laugh, but that's because I have the material. I think it has something, and I never read from my books. I always read from other stuff, and because that you need context and all that stuff. I really just see it. I think if more authors saw the reading as a form of entertainment and a not a way to kind of present their work or sell a book or do all, like, but really think about the audience. It's about the audience and it's not about the reader. Yeah, it's such important. So for me, I'm trying to entertain. That's when I'm up there. And if I had a dramatic story that I thought was really compelling and entertaining, yeah, I'd read the shit out of that. But I got, you know, just a long series of dick jokes, and that's, I'm going to go for that, like, because I am not, there's no such thing as an easy laugh, and I'll take whichever ones I can get, like, you know.
Well, it's funny, you know, in the 80s, I saw Allen Ginsberg read at in Berkeley, and in like a big, can't remember where it was, but it was a big auditorium, big, you know, arena type setting. And I went in thinking, you know, it's Allen Ginsberg, you know, it's going to be a snooze, I better be patient. And he definitely embraced that idea of know your audience and know their limitations. And he was funny. He was engaging. He brought out his little, you know, his little squeeze box, whatever, did some songs, but he never let it get to that bizarre, frozen stiff poetry reading status. You know, he always kept it moving like it was a comedy show. And that this is like, you know, arguably the most stereotypical beatnik beer can walk down the beach poet in history. But he managed to still do that, to treat his audience with enough respect to not bore the crap out of them. And that always stuck with me.
Right. You know? It's exactly what you said. It's respect. It's respect. You know, it's people came out to see you. You want to be as good as the audience is. You want to be, they're there. I don't know. I mean, I just think that's a really important idea to, I never, you know, and I go short usually. Like, I don't want to overstay my welcome, you know.
Yeah.
But if your material is good, go. Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. For me, it's fine. But, I mean, like I said, it's, you know, other people don't have that option. Like, I have all that, you know.
My own
write
personal,
funny, so I...
My the only time I've upturned that philosophy is I once read, I think at a noir at the bar in San Francisco, a section of Hustle, which, you know, like you say, you need context, and it was out of, you know, it was a tough thing to do and read a segment from the novel, but it was a scene where this kid gets anally raped with the muzzle of a gun, and it was so brutal and so horrific, and Josh Stallings brought his mother, of all things, and
perfect.
See, it was not funny, and it was dark and weird, and there were silence afterwards. However, now it makes for a funny story. So, you know, I still managed to get the humor and laugh, but it took a few months for it.
Yeah.
For people to digest it.
Thing is, I would have. Now, see, I have such a thing as, like, I know what the moment. Like, I honestly would have had to. If everyone was silent, I would have left, leave the room laughing, because I've seen people read stuff that's like they're really going for that. Like, okay, this is extreme. There's extreme imagery. It's really, and I just think that's the funniest way to go. Like, I think it's so awesome. So, yeah, but I have a silly, I have a, no. I love it. But Danny Gardner asked me that recently. And I didn't even think about doing readings as a part of this job until I was asked to do a reading when Dove Season came out, or when I started to do like bookstore stuff. And I was like, oh shit, am I gonna, you know, it's not like I prepared or anything. I was just like, I'll read this. My very first reading was me and Joe Lansdale. That was it.
Wow.
At Poison Pen together. Nice. So no pressure. Right. So, then the next time I followed like Gary Phillips, like, which makes me sound like Tiny Tim, like but I picked the material well. Like then I was reading from there's what I call the piss fight in Dove Season. That reads really well. And it's the right length, and it closes strong, and it's just a fight scene. So there's not a lot of dialogue. So it's just, you know, you're describing this really, I would describe it like I describe a bar story. And it's, you know, 5.5 minutes or something. Like, it's short enough. And I was like, oh, people dig this. And then I dig through other stuff that I'd written. And then you end up, like you said, you have your go-tos. You have like, okay, this one crushes. Like this, like we'll do this one. And depending on the place, the first time I read in the library, I had to write something because I didn't have anything clean. Like, and I was like, oh, crap. And so, but that, even that's my kind of go-to clean story. It usually kills. And, so like with the readings, I didn't know it was a thing that you did. So I didn't really, over time, I started to get an idea of like, okay, make it shorter, and develop that as, and then seeing other people that just are amazing reading.
I'm just going to toss this out there one more time because I don't know if it's the same call or not, but it pops up and then it disappears. So I'll announce that.
Okay, yeah.
It's the guest calling, if you care to call in and give us a shout, is 347-633-6909. If you want to call, please do. If not, then just keep on listening on the edge of your seat. Speaking of you coming up and your early experiences and stuff, how much did Blood and Tacos augment your career, and what did you take away from that?
Not I would say zero. Whatever. I don't know it was what I did is I write Dove Season, and Dove Season comes out on a Tuesday, like in whatever September of about 5 years ago, and on Wednesday I flew to my first BoucherCon. So like it comes out on Tuesday, I fly to BoucherCon, which is a big, for those who don't know, a big mystery writers and readers convention. In St. Louis. And so it all felt like, and I didn't know anybody. I knew one guy. I knew Bill Cameron, because he was from Oregon and I had met him and he had blurbed the book. And so I show up. I don't know anybody. And by the time I leave, I know everybody. Like, whatever. Yeah. Like, you're in the bar. I met everybody. Like, I mean, met whoever, Daniel Woodrell. Like, I mean, I met everybody. And I was like, holy shit, this is a really supportive, inclusive environment, community. Like, it's not like screenwriters who only talk about money and try to fuck each other over. Like, it really is an amazing community. And I had the idea, originally I was going to write the story, the Chingon story that's in the very first Blood and Tacos. I was going to write it as a hoax. I was going to say, oh, I found this story from the past and written by a Grace Godfrey. And whatever, and Roxy, my wife, who's a painter, was going to paint the cover and whatever. Like, it's going to be this big thing, and then Ray Banks was going to be like, oh, yeah, I remember that, whatever. Like, so I was going to develop, and I was like, what's the upside? That's just a shit ton of work for no reward. Like, but I told the idea.
The person who's calling in, I'll get to you in 1 second. I know you've been holding for about 2 minutes. Just hang tight. And sorry to interrupt you.
I could finish in like 30 seconds.
Yeah,
knock yourself out. Go ahead. Oh, and then so I told the idea of like I would like to get writers to write fake men's adventure books from the 70s and 80s. They can create their own authors, create their own characters, and then little adventures. I told the idea to Cameron Ashley, who does Crime Factory in Australia. He was there. And he was like, oh, you're doing that. That's happening. I'm writing one, obviously. I'm going to tell whatever. So I was like, oh yeah, whatever. Who are you? I literally met you 10 minutes ago. And then I walk into the bar in St. Louis and Gary Phillips, who's a big guy, looks at me. Well, I've never met him, and just starts beelining toward me. And I was like, okay, so what's going down? What's happening? Like, it was like, he's an intimidating dude. And he comes up to me and just goes, you know, he said, oh, most excellent, baby. Like, whatever. He's just like, he just tells me, like, he pitches me his entire story for Blood. It wasn't called Blood and Tide. It was called something else. Or we didn't have a name yet. He just pitches me the entire, like, honestly, like, corners me and says, like, oh, I'm going to write The Silencer, and it's going to have this, and it's going to be all. And I was like, okay, now I got to do it. You know, like, and I had a publisher for it. I didn't put any money. We paid all the writers got paid and we put it out, and I committed to doing it as a quarterly, doing four and then deciding. And I felt like the joke died after four, like, or it was about done. And it was just more work. It was a lot of work. Yeah, it was, but it was just a lot of work. And it was really specific. If you wrote for me, you couldn't do anything with that story if I didn't accept it. Like, and I didn't,
right.
That was a hard thing. So mostly I was at, like, for each issue, if it had five stories, I maybe was reading seven stories. Like, I didn't spread, I usually asked people, and then I tried to keep it kind of small, because that was a big ask, in a way. Like, so, and it didn't, I mean, it paid, but not that much. And so I think I met a lot of people because of that. Like, and I got to work with certain people.
The political advantage. Well, listen, let's take this call.
Well, go ahead. Take it.
I just want to throw them off. It's my Canadianness. I hate to be rude. I feel like they're going to hang up on us again. Give me one second. Hey, welcome to Skid Row Chatter. You're on the air with Johnny Shaw.
Hey, I had two questions for the author, two best related questions.
Well, let me ask you real quick. Who are you?
I'm a big fan of Johnny Shaw, starting with his Dove Season novel. And when he was talking about the piss fight scene, it made me think of a question for him.
Shoot.
Where is theoretically the best place in Mexicali to go get Chaunch or see Chaunch?
If you've read my books, you just heard from the original, the real Buck. That's, I believe, I would recognize your voice anywhere, Buck. Who, is he the one that keeps calling? You should have kept on the line longer.
Okay.
First time, long time. Yeah. Do you know which bar in Mexicali that is? The strip joint? The strip joint's El Patio, which was right near the border crossing. The bar was actually kind of made up. But the Chaunch, who made up the word Chaunch? Was it Calbert?
Calbert.
I'm asking him now.
I believe. I don't know.
He definitely used that word the most. That was kind of a catch-all word when we were in high school. Chaunch. We won't go into that. I'll ask you while I got you on the line, Buck, because it's because my editor, is editing my new book, and it's the third Jimmy Veeder book, and I use the word chonies. You know what chonies are, right?
Yeah.
I know what chonies are.
Underwear. There you go. See? And so my editor's, I was like shocked. I was like, I almost asked for a new editor. So,
regional. It might be regional, though. Could be.
Yeah. Tom knows.
I know because I've been in California long enough, but in Canada, the nomenclature was Gaunch. Gaunch and, of course, if you're a female, Ginch. But, yeah.
There you go. Yeah, obviously, because that's the feminine. Yeah.
What was your second question there, world famous Buck?
The second question was what's the best way to make a fruit cordial?
Oh, no. See, I only use that as a setup, but because you know the answer. I'm not going to say the punchline. Never mind. I'm not going to have a private conversation with Buck.
That was from a reading I did.
Go ahead.
I'll see you later, Buck. I'll call you.
All right. Bye.
Thanks for the call
in. Bye.
Celebrity
call.
That's pretty fancy.
Yeah, exactly. When I read at the last North the Bar LA that I read at, he lives in like Orange County now, so he came up and I had him actually read with me at the North Bar.
I remember that.
So,
but at that point, I hadn't read Dove Season, so I didn't know who he was.
Yeah, that was that's Buck. To be fair to him, I only use his name. I don't like he's not a dumbass much. I mean, I'm glad he called in. That made me feel good.
Let me ask you.
I recognized his voice.
That bizarre reading in L.A. where you told the story, it was basically Lee Marvin going into the police station and reporting a riot at Studio 54.
Where is that published? Where can one find that story?
The aforementioned Cameron Ashley in Australia, Crime Factory, Bob Lee, just called Lee, L-E-E.
Oh, yeah.
That is an anthology that it's kind of a biography of Lee Marvin and different writers or different chapters of his life. So Ray Banks is in it. Adrian McKinty, I believe, is in it. I forget who, Jimmy Calloway is in it. There's a whole bunch of people. Eric Buettner is in it and did the cover. There's a whole bunch of people in it, and it kind of spans. And we just kind of picked an era, and I picked the Big Red One.
It was a good one.
That one turned out all right.
All right, we're coming up against it, so I want to ask you a few more questions that have been eating at me. When I first met you, it was in Albany, the night you won the Anthony, and it was a big deal for me. I was, yay, one of our team, and it really seems like since then, the Anthonys have been kicked, the door's been kicked open. Each year, I see more nominees by people that I know and people that are more of the from the neo-noir crowd, for lack of a better term. How did the Anthonys change your life and your career?
Oh, it was, it was nice, obviously. It's nice getting an award that's, from the readers and from everybody and from that community. Like, it's one of the reasons the Anthonys are different is, like, I can't imagine someone that doesn't go to BoucherCon winning an Anthony. So it does have, there's a familiarity element to the Anthonys that are tied to BoucherCon.
Yeah,
not taking away from any of the nominees or books or whatever but it's also the person as well as the book. So
yeah.
Which is fine. Luckily then I felt like when I won it, I knew some people, but I definitely didn't know the number of people I do now after going to whatever 5 BoucherCons or however many. I didn't obviously didn't think I was gonna win. It's that thing, you feel good about I think my publisher was really happy, so partly because of, because I'm published by Thomas and Mercer, which is part of Amazon, and they were, it was good to start getting awards as well as all the sales they were getting. And I think that was a very positive thing, just to be to really not feel like an outsider and be a part of that community. And it didn't affect sales at all. I hate to break it to anybody. not any way noticeably for me. Although that said, my next book was the first one that was reviewed by all the trade, Publishers Weekly and Kirkus and Library Journal.
Yeah.
I think that maybe felt like they should do like that because I won this. I'm guessing that was one of the factors because I was an Anthony Award winner. It gave me put me on that list or whatever it is. That was nice. And maybe it does have an impact on sales, but just not like an immediate bam, because it's, I'm very honored to have won. I still just write books, so they're books, right? The path to riches isn't doing what I do, which is writing books and being an adjunct faculty member. It's not. No, my wife might have made a mistake.
Let's blame it on her. That's what you call passive aggressive.
Sure.
It was my wife's mistake to marry me.
We call her.
I never intended to be a better man. Listen, when I told my pal Joe Clifford that you were coming on the show, he said, Johnny Shaw, the self-made man. I go, what do you mean he's a self-made man? And he said he's built his empire. I think that's the word he used. All himself, and meaning that. You fly solo. Are you unagented? Are you just your own back office?
Yeah, as a screenwriter and as an author, I guess. Yeah, I've never had an agent. Never. And
wow.
I'm not opposed to it. I'm not. This is not any kind of indictment.
Yeah.
I think agents are great. I'm probably at the point where it'd be a good idea. It sounds weird, but just for other, not things I'm not going to go into. I probably have a much better career if I did have any. So it's not an indictment of agents. I'm not opposed to agents. I just, when I was a screenwriter, and even now, I like to focus on the work, and I get to this point where I was like, okay, I got to pursue getting published or looking for an agent, because they're both kind of full-time jobs. And sometimes I've done, in the past, I had done this, both of them kind of simultaneously. I'd be like, oh, I'm going to look for an agent while I do this. And then I would just get a deal offered to me, and I'd be like, okay, fuck it. I don't need that agent because I got this thing in front of me. That's what happened as a screenwriter. I would pursue work, and I would get work. And so I'd be like, I don't understand why. And I get someone to look at contracts, and I can read a contract pretty well now, but I got a lawyer, whatever. Like, I do that, so I'm not, just completely. But I don't have anybody that I'm not signed to anybody. I don't have any kind of
right. Well, the
but that's
path
just pure luck. That's blind luck.
Well, the path to Dove Season getting published was unusual. So that, I think maybe that allowed you to sort of to be able to skip that step successfully. And
that's
good fortune.
It was good fortune, and then I developed a relationship that I didn't really need to tamper with, at least to any point. So it was, there was a point I could concentrate on the work. And like I said, whether it was a smart thing to do or not, it was what I kind of needed to do in the moment to get the work done. And because it's so much work to look for. Now, it would be almost the opposite, because I could make someone's money, and an agent would just be, I'm going to, but how do I know that they're really going to support what I do and give me the things that I can't do myself?
And be
which is like film and porn and all that other stuff.
Yeah.
It has to be something I can't do myself. It's a changing environment. You can, I don't know, like it, I'm not saying, again, it's, I want to be very clear, but it's, obviously, I did it. You can do it without an agent. I mean, that's totally possible. It's not, I think they can make it a lot easier. I think they can probably get maybe better deals. They can be, if you are working with someone that can't handle both negotiating and working creatively, that can be complex. But if you can yell at each other about money, go get a beer, and then have a really good conversation about the creative moments of a book, that's a relationship you want anyway. So having like this bulldog that everyone knows is doing what you told them to do or what you agreed to do, that's just like smoke and mirrors. If you be a grown up and you can talk about things that aren't personal without making them personal, then you can do it with,
Well,
so, but most of it's luck.
Speaking of being a big shot and having people do things for you, audiobooks, for a guy that, I listened to part of a couple. And I won't say which, because I don't want to disparage the reader. One I really thought had your cadence, your vibe, and more importantly, the shifting characters down really well. And I enjoyed part. I was going back and forth between them. I'd listen on the way to work, and I'd get to work and read what I'd been listening to, that kind of thing. And another one, it didn't crack me as well. And I thought, man, for a guy who has such a strong reading voice live and it had such a clear and identifiable voice, I was wondering why you chose to allow somebody else to do the audiobooks. Have you thought about doing them yourself?
No, I never even thought about it. It's like I think I have kind of a monotone. Like I don't that it'll lull you to sleep over time. I don't know if mine, I'm not going to do like characters like some of the people do. Like, what am I going to do? Yeah, I'll do my great like Mexican accent. Like that's something you never want to hear. People would hate me if I did that. Like, so I don't know if I could do the acting that's required. I was never asked to do it. They just did it. Like they were like, here's your audiobook, and I was like, awesome, whatever. Like honestly, I don't really. I like audiobooks. I think they're interesting, but if it's not I'm actually, because of the way podcasts are changing, I'm interested in like radio drama and other things like that. But I would do that separately, exclusively. As written, like I don't write it as an audiobook, so I think an audiobook, while I would argue that it's its own medium and its own form, that's not what it was written for, so it's always kind of modified. Like Floodgate, I would question how well that worked because of the way it jumps around and because of the way it's structured and the way, like, that was meant for the page, whereas the other ones probably read a little better. It's almost right. Not fair to the person reading, because there's a lot to do to differentiate how that book's written because of the way it's shaped. It's a little more complex to do it in audio. And so, you know, me doing it, I guess, I mean, I would do it if they wanted me to do it, and I would do my best. I'm not convinced I'm the right guy to do it, though.
I just, as a reader and a fan and a guy who's heard you read, I think it's something that if I were you, I would explore it. But hey, I'm not your agent, clearly. I will say that.
Oh, no, obviously, like, yeah.
You said that.
You want to be? There's an opening. There's an opening. You could represent me.
Get in line, Pip. Get in line. You said that Floodgate was more ambitious than your other books. And here's, at 6:57, we got a couple more minutes. Let me ask you, do you still feel like you're getting better with each book? Like, that's the goal, right? Do you feel like that's...
You act better? Like, do I still feel like I'm getting better? Like, that's like, oh, yeah, obviously you feel like you're getting better, but now do you feel like you're getting better?
Are you sure?
I feel like no, of course not. No, it's you're getting different. The one thing, it's what I tell my students. I'll tell them, I'm not like a better writer than you. I'm a more experienced writer than you. That's a fact. Like, I've done it more than you. Like, it doesn't mean I'm better. So I think with that, the way I'd answer that is like, yeah, I'm more experienced. I can figure certain stuff out, and I know my structure. Even if I'm doing a structure that's not kind of by the book, I know why I'm doing it, and I can kind of explain how I'm doing it. I know my craft fairly well. I'm getting better at knowing where the commas go, which my copy editor berates me for. You would never know in the final thing because they fix all that, but. I take the craft really seriously.
No, just that strange voice came in and was it's like an angel
okay.
on my shoulder.
I didn't know. So I mean, I take the craft really seriously, but I don't, as long as I'll always have, every one of my books will have more, I have more ambition than talent. Like I'll always try to write to the ceiling of my talent. I'll always try to push it to the point where I might fail, because that's when something interesting is made. So it's the ambition will keep me from the books from getting just consistently better. Like, to me, if that was happening, it was because I was just doing shit I knew how to do already. So if I challenge myself, some of my books are just going to be awful in the future at some point, because I just tried to do something I wasn't ready to do.
You keep planning on that. We'll see if it actually comes to bear fruit. I don't know. But listen, we're getting squeezed for time. The lady's giving us a shove. I want to thank you very much for being a guest on the Fabulous Skid Row Chatter. Next month, our guest is none other than Eric Buettner. Who doesn't love Eric Buettner, huh?
Great guy.
I know. You just want to give him a big squeeze. All right. Well, thank you. Hey, Johnny, it's been a pleasure. 10 seconds. I've been on a Johnny Shaw spree the past couple months, and I've read 3 books in a row, and it's just been a pleasure getting to know you via the fiction. Thank you again for being on.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was fun. I hope it was marginally interesting. Like, and everyone got to meet Buck, which I'm really, really happy about.
All right. Thank you. Good night. We'll talk to you in the interweb. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.